A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You know, Korn, this whole show runs on GPU compute, and we wouldn't be here without Modal.
Seriously. And that's what powers all our text-to-speech. Everything you're hearing right now.
They're an AI infrastructure platform. Developers use them to run GPU workloads in the cloud with zero infrastructure headaches.
If you're building anything with AI, check them out. Modal.com. You ever just stop and think about the fact that we are basically swimming in an invisible ocean of data? Right now, passing through your body, through this room, through the walls, there are thousands of different frequencies carrying everything from high-speed internet to heartbeat monitors and submarine commands. It is this finite, invisible resource that we all depend on, but almost nobody actually sees the map of how it is laid out.
It is the ultimate real estate market, Korn. And just like real estate, they are not making any more of it. I am Herman Poppleberry, and today we are taking the grand tour. We are looking at the entire radio spectrum from the basement to the attic. Daniel's prompt today is basically asking us to map the world of wireless, from the massive waves of the low frequencies to the tiny, high-energy pulses of millimeter wave and satellite bands.
It is a great one because we usually talk about these things in isolation. We talk about Wi-Fi or we talk about 5G. But we rarely look at the neighborly disputes happening between them. And by the way, if you are wondering how we are putting this together, today's episode is powered by Google Gemini 3 Flash. It is helping us navigate this massive frequency chart. So, Herman, where do we actually start? Because radio is a much bigger word than people realize.
It really is. Most people think radio starts at the FM dial, but we have to go way lower. We start at the VLF, or very low frequency band. We are talking 3 to 30 kilohertz. To give you some perspective on the physics here, a single radio wave at these frequencies can be tens of kilometers long. Because the waves are so huge, they can actually penetrate seawater.
Right, which is why the military uses them for submarines. You can't exactly catch a 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi signal 100 meters underwater. The physics just says no.
Well, the physics says the water absorbs the energy and turns it into heat before it gets to the antenna. But with VLF, you can signal a sub. The downside is the data rate is abysmal. You are basically sending text-based commands at a crawl. You aren't streaming Netflix to the USS Pennsylvania.
Dive, dive, dive. Takes about 10 minutes to transmit. Got it. So we move up from the basement. What's next on the ladder?
We hit the LF and MF bands, low frequency and medium frequency. This is where we find long wave and the standard AM radio band, roughly 500 to 1700 kilohertz. This is the world of ground wave propagation. These signals hug the Earth's curvature. This is why you can hear an AM station from two states away at night.
It's funny how we've relegated AM to talk radio and emergency alerts, but in terms of coverage per watt, it's still a beast. If the grid goes down, the guy with the AM transmitter is the only one anyone is going to hear.
It's the resilience king. But as we move into HF, or high frequency, which is 3 to 30 megahertz, things get weird. This is the shortwave band. This is where the signal doesn't just hug the ground. It hits the ionosphere and bounces back down. You can skip a signal halfway around the planet with the right atmospheric conditions. This is where you find amateur radio enthusiasts, international broadcasters, and even NFC near-field communication.
Wait, hold on. NFC? Like when I tap my phone to buy a sandwich? That's happening in the same neighborhood as shortwave radio?
It's specifically at 13.56 megahertz. It's an ISM band, industrial, scientific, and medical. It's a tiny little slice of the HF spectrum. The reason it's used for tapping your phone is that at that frequency, the near-field magnetic induction is very predictable. It only works over a few centimeters, which is exactly what you want for a credit card transaction. You don't want your payment signal bouncing off the ionosphere and being picked up by a guy in Madagascar.
Someone just bought a ham on rye in New Jersey, says the guy in Antananarivo. Yeah, that would be a security nightmare. But wait, if NFC is in the same band as shortwave, why doesn't my phone start buzzing every time a ham radio operator in Ohio keys up their mic?
That's where the near field part of NFC comes in. It's not using the radiative part of the electromagnetic field, it's using the inductive part. It's essentially a very weak transformer. The signal drops off so fast, literally following the inverse cube law, that once you're 6 inches away, the signal is essentially gone. Shortwave radio, on the other hand, is designed to radiate. It's the difference between a flashlight and a magnet.
Okay, so we've gone from submarines to credit cards. Now we're getting into the stuff people actually recognize, right? The VHF and UHF bands.
This is where the modern world lives. VHF, very high frequency, is 30 to 300 megahertz. Think FM radio, air traffic control, and those old school rabbit ear TV channels. This is where the transition happens from waves that bend around obstacles to line of sight. Communication. If you can't see the tower, or at least have a pretty clear path to it, the signal starts to struggle.
This is also where marine radio sits, right? I remember looking at a boat's radio, and it was all in the 150 megahertz range.
Yes, marine VHF is right around 156 megahertz. It's perfect for line of sight across the water. But the real heavy lifter, the most valuable real estate in the history of humanity, is UHF ultra-high frequency, 300 megahertz to 3 gigahertz. This is the sweet spot.
Why is it the sweet spot? Is it just because we decided to put everything there, or is there a physical reason?
It's the perfect balance of physics. The waves are small enough that the antennas can be tiny, like the ones inside your smartphone, but they are large enough to still pass through walls and trees fairly well. If you go lower, the antennas get too big for a pocket. If you go higher, a single brick wall can kill your signal. So, we crammed everything into UHF. 4G, 5G, GPS, Bluetooth, Zigbee, Wi-Fi, it's a crowded house.
And this is where the ISM bands really start to get interesting, because this is the unlicensed territory. It's the Wild West.
It really is. The 2.4 GHz band is the classic example. It was originally set aside for microwave ovens because 2.4 GHz is the frequency that makes water molecules vibrate and heat up. Since the band was already noisy because of ovens, the regulators basically said, fine, anyone can use this for low power communication without a license.
And then we decided to put the entire internet on it.
Everything. Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, Zigbee, baby monitors, cordless phones. It's a miracle it works at all. The only reason it does is because of incredibly smart protocols. Zigbee, for instance, is designed to find the quiet spots between Wi-Fi channels. It's like a small mouse scurrying across a busy highway, trying not to get hit by a semi-truck of data.
But how does Bluetooth manage that? I've got a Bluetooth mouse, a headset, and a watch all connected to my phone right now, and my Wi-Fi is still running. How do they not just scream over each other?
Bluetooth is a master of frequency hopping spread spectrum. It literally changes its frequency 1600 times per second. It hops all over that 2.4 GHz band. If it hits a frequency that's busy with Wi-Fi, it just hops to the next one. It's so fast that your ear or your mouse cursor never notices the millisecond of interference. It's like a conversation where the two people are teleporting around the room while they talk to stay away from other groups.
That's wild. But I've always wondered about LoRa, though. We talk about it for long-range sensors, like those smart water meters or agricultural sensors. Where does that sit in this UHF mess?
In North America, LoRa lives at 915 megahertz. That's a lower frequency than Wi-Fi, which gives it that incredible range. It can go miles because those 900 megahertz waves are better at diffracting around hills and buildings. But again, it's an ISM band. You share it with old cordless phones and smart meters.
It's funny how we've partitioned these things. It's like a city where the submarines are in the sewers. The AM radio is the massive interstate highway, and Wi-Fi is the crowded sidewalk where everyone is shouting. But what happens when we go even higher? Because I know 5G is pushing us into frequencies that sound like science fiction.
We move into SHF super high frequency, 3 to 30 gigahertz. This is where we find the high performance Wi-Fi, like 5 gigahertz and the new 6 gigahertz bands. It's also where satellite communication really takes over. And this is where we need to talk about the letter bands. You've heard of L-band, C-band, Ku-band?
I've heard the terms, but they always sounded like military jargon. What's the actual difference?
It's all about the trade-off between bandwidth and weather. L-band is low frequency for satellites, 1 to 2 GHz. This is where GPS lives. Because the frequency is relatively low, the signal is incredibly robust. It can pass through clouds, rain, and even some light foliage. That's why your GPS works even when it's pouring rain.
But you can't get much data through it.
Right. It's great for I am here coordinates, which is just a tiny bit of data. But if you want to stream a movie via satellite, you have to go higher. You move up to C-band 4 to 8 GHz, which is what traditional satellite TV uses. But the big player right now, especially with Starlink, is Ku-band, 12 to 18 GHz.
That's where the rain fade starts to happen, isn't it? I remember people complaining that their satellite TV would cut out during a thunderstorm.
When the wavelength gets that small, around 2 centimeters, a raindrop is actually large enough to absorb or scatter the signal. The higher you go, the more the atmosphere hates you. Starlink uses Ku-band for the user terminals, and then it uses K-band 26 to 40 GHz for the gateway, links that connect the satellites to the actual internet on the ground.
So Starlink is essentially juggling different frequencies depending on who it's talking to. It's like speaking a different language to the customer than it does to the head office.
And it gets even more intense. In early 26, we are seeing the opening of the V-band, 40 to 75 GHz. The FCC just opened up massive chunks of this for fixed satellite services. These mega constellations like Starlink and Kuiper are running out of room in the lower bands. They need the massive pipe that only these high frequencies can provide.
But wait, how do they deal with the physics of V-band? If the atmosphere is that hostile, does the signal even reach the ground?
Barely. At 60 GHz, oxygen molecules actually absorb the energy. The air itself is the enemy. This is a phenomenon called molecular oxygen absorption. The oxygen molecules literally vibrate and take the energy out of the radio wave.
That sounds like a terrible choice for a satellite, then. Why use it?
Well, for satellite-to-satellite links in the vacuum of space, it's brilliant because there's no oxygen. But for ground links, 60 GHz is actually great for short-range, high-security stuff. If you want to beam data across a room at 10 gigabits per second, but you don't want the signal to leak out into the street where a hacker can see it, 60 GHz is perfect. The air literally kills the signal after 50 meters. It's self-walling.
That is a wild way to think about it. The weakness of the frequency becomes a security feature. It's like a conversation that only exists within a 10-foot bubble. But what about the 5G millimeter wave everyone was terrified of a few years ago? Where does that sit in this tour?
That's EHF, extremely high frequency, 30 to 300 GHz. This is the millimeter wave territory. Most 5G ultra-wideband is sitting around 24 to 39 GHz. It offers insane speeds, but you basically have to be able to see the tower. If a bus drives between you and the small cell, your speed drops.
It's like the flashlight version of the internet. If you can see the beam, you're golden. If you step behind a tree, you're back to 4G.
And the current frontier, the big regulatory battle at 26, is the push into the sub-terahertz range. We are talking 100 GHz and up. This is where 6G is being tested. We are looking at terabits per second. But at those frequencies, even your hand blocking the phone could kill the connection.
It feels like we're reaching the limit of what radio can actually do. If we go much higher, aren't we just talking about infrared light?
We are. That's exactly what's happening. The line between radio waves and light waves is blurring. We are starting to use lasers for satellite-to-satellite links, optical wireless communication, because there is no spectrum regulation in a vacuum and the bandwidth is essentially infinite. But for anything that has to pass through our atmosphere, we are stuck playing this game of musical chairs with the spectrum.
And the chairs are getting very expensive. I saw that the recent mid-band auctions for 5G went for tens of billions of dollars. It's crazy that a frequency can be worth more than a small country's GDP.
It's because it's the only way to scale. If you own the 4 GHz range, you own the future of mobile data for the next decade. But what's interesting is that we're moving away from, I own this forever, and toward AI-driven dynamic allocation.
Explain that, because that sounds like a mess. How do you share frequency without everyone talking over each other? Is it like the Bluetooth hopping, but on a massive scale?
Think of it like a smart traffic light system. Instead of giving one company a lane on the highway that stays empty 90% of the time, we use a central database, like the CBRS system in the US. CBRS stands for Citizens Broadband Radio Service. It's in the 3.5 GHz range.
I've heard of this. It's the innovation band, right?
It has three tiers. The top tier is the U.S. Navy, which uses it for radar. They have priority. If a carrier group pulls into port, they take over. The second tier is for companies that paid for priority access. And the third tier is general authorized access, basically free for anyone to use for private LTE or 5G networks. An AI-managed system monitors who is where and shifts the signals around so nobody interferes with the Navy.
That is a much more efficient use of the land. It's like a community garden where you can plant stuff, but if the owner shows up to build a shed, you have to move your tomatoes.
It's the only way forward. We can't just keep slicing the pie thinner. We have to start sharing the same slices. And that brings up the big conflict of 26, the battle between satellite operators and terrestrial mobile carriers.
Oh, I've been following this. This is the direct-to-cell stuff, right? Where Starlink wants to talk directly to your unmodified iPhone.
Yes, they want to use the cellular frequencies, the ones owned by T-Mobile or AT&T, from space. But the terrestrial carriers are worried that a satellite beaming down on those same frequencies will drown out their ground towers. It's a massive coordination headache. You have to ensure that the satellite beam mutes itself over areas where a ground tower is active.
It's like trying to have two different conversations in the same room, but one person is shouting from a balcony and the other is whispering in your ear. If they don't time it perfectly, you hear nothing but noise. Does that mean the phone has to be smarter or the satellite?
Both, but primarily the satellite. It has to use beamforming to create very precise footprints of coverage that avoid specific ground stations. It's like using a stage spotlight that can change shape instantly to avoid hitting a person standing in the middle of the stage. If they get it wrong, noise means thousands of people lose their 911 access or their data connection drops. The regulators at the FCC and the ITU, the International Telecommunication Union, are basically the referees in this global wrestling match.
It's wild to think that Daniel's prompt covers everything from the literal bottom of the ocean to the edge of the atmosphere. It really is a map of human ambition. We've found a way to use every single vibration of the electromagnetic field to do something useful.
Every single one. We even use the gaps. There is a thing called TV white spaces, where we use the empty channels between television stations to provide long-range internet to rural areas. We are scavengers now, Korn. We are looking for every little scrap of unused spectrum.
So for the person listening to this on their phone right now, what's the takeaway? Besides the fact that their head is currently being pierced by 1,000 different bands.
The first takeaway is understanding the frequency versus range trade-off. If you are setting up a smart home and you have the choice between a 2.4 GHz device and a 900 MHz device like LoRa or some versions of Zigbee, the 900 MHz one will be way more reliable through walls. Don't just assume higher number equals better. Usually, in a house, lower is better.
I learned that the hard way with my Wi-Fi. I forced everything to 5 GHz for the speed, and then I realized my smart fridge in the kitchen couldn't talk to the router because there was a pantry in the way.
5 GHz is a Ferrari that crashes into the first wall it sees. 2.4 GHz is the old truck that can make it through the mud. And the second takeaway is to keep an eye on these spectrum auctions. It sounds like boring policy stuff, but it's actually what determines if you'll have great internet in 3 years. When you see a C-band auction happening, that's the signal that a massive surge in mobile speed is coming to your neighborhood.
It's the infrastructure of the future, just without the orange cones and the steamrollers. But what about the health side? I know we aren't doctors, but people always ask, is this ocean of waves actually safe?
That's a common concern, but the physics is pretty clear. All of the frequencies we've talked about today are non-ionizing radiation. That means the waves don't have enough energy to knock electrons off atoms or damage DNA. It's not like X-rays or gamma rays. The only thing these radio waves can really do to human tissue is heat it up slightly, and the power levels we use are so low that the heating is negligible. You get more radiation sitting in front of a campfire than you do from a 5G tower.
Good to know. I'm not being cooked by my Bluetooth headphones. And finally, pay attention to spectrum sharing. The era of unlicensed versus licensed is ending. We're moving into a world where your devices will be much smarter about sniffing the air and finding an open frequency on the fly. It's going to make the crowded 2.4 GHz band feel much less crowded because devices won't be shouting over each other anymore. They'll be whispering in the gaps. I like that. A more polite internet. Or at least a more efficient one. Honestly, looking at the spectrum as a whole, it's a bit like looking at a map of a massive ancient city. There are the old, wide avenues of AM radio, the dense downtown of UHF, and then these high-tech glass skyscrapers of millimeter wave being built on the outskirts.
And just like a city, it's always under construction. We are already talking about 6G and terahertz waves, which is effectively moving into the suburbs that don't even have roads yet. We are trying to figure out how to build the antennas and the chips that can handle those insane vibrations.
Well, I think we've successfully mapped the territory. From the submarines to the Starlink gateways, the radio spectrum is the most valuable invisible thing we own.
It really is. And as we push higher and higher, the physics only gets weirder. I'm looking forward to the day we're talking about gamma-ray Wi-Fi, though I suspect the health regulators might have a few words about that.
Yeah, get 10 gigabits per second and a slight glow-in-the-dark tan. Maybe we'll stick to the radio waves for now. This has been a fascinating dive, Herman. I actually feel like I can see the air a little better now.
That's the goal. Next time you see a weird-looking antenna on a building, you can look at the size of it and probably guess exactly what part of the spectrum it's talking to. Big antenna? Low frequency. Tiny little nub? High-speed data.
Size matters in physics. Who knew? Well, that is our tour of the spectrum. Big thanks as always to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping us on the right frequency.
And a huge thanks to Modal for providing the GPU credits that power the generation of this show. They are the backbone of our technical pipeline.
If you enjoyed this deep dive into the invisible world, do us a favor and leave a review on whatever podcast app you're using. It actually helps new people find the show, and it makes Herman feel like all that reading of FCC filings was worth it.
It is always worth it, Korn. The spectrum never sleeps.
Neither do you, apparently. This has been my weird prompts. We'll catch you in the next one.
See ya.
This episode was produced using Google Gemini 3 Flash. Text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where all thoughts go from slow.